for more than a year were released by the government of Iran. Peace through strength had been one of Reagan's campaign slogans, and his administration soon began the largest peacetime military buildup in the history of the United States. Over the next 5 years, America's defense budget would almost double, and the arms race with the Soviet Union would be deliberately accelerated out of a belief that the United States could win it. Reagan opposed not only détente, but every arms control agreement that the United States had signed with the Soviet Union. In a 1963 speech, he said that President Kennedy's foreign policy was motivated by fear of the bomb, and that in an all-out race, our system is stronger, and eventually the enemy gives up the race as a hopeless cause. The following year, Reagan described the Soviets as the most evil enemy that has ever faced mankind. His views on the subject remained largely unchanged for the next 2 decades. He was the first president since Woodrow Wilson who sincerely believed that American military power could bring an end to communism in the Soviet Union. Most of Reagan's foreign policy advisors belonged to the Committee on the Present Danger, and they pushed for bold nuclear policies. The counterforce strategy once proposed by Robert McNamara, long associated with Rand and the youthful self-confidence of the early Kennedy administration, was now embraced by conservative Republicans. But the word counterforce had become problematic. It sounded aggressive and implied the willingness to fight a nuclear war. Much the same strategy was now called damage limitation. By launching a nuclear attack on Soviet military targets, the United States might limit the damage to its own territory and perhaps emerge victorious. The new Secretary of Defense, Caspar "Cap" Weinberger, was, like McNamara, a businessman who'd served in the Army during the Second World War, but knew little about nuclear weapons. As a result, his Undersecretary of Defense for Policy, Fred Eakley, played an important role in the Reagan administration's strategic decisions. Eakley was still haunted by the possibility that deterrence might fail. Through an accident, a miscalculation, the actions of a fanatic in the Kremlin. And if that happened, millions of Americans would die. Eakley considered the all-or-nothing philosophy of assured destruction to be profoundly immoral, a misnomer more accurately described as assured genocide. Aiming nuclear weapons at civilian populations threatened a form of warfare universally condemned since the Dark Ages, the mass killing of hostages. He pushed the Reagan administration to seek a nuclear strategy that would deter the Soviets from attacking or blackmailing the United States, maintain the ability to fight a protracted nuclear war, limit American damage if that war occurred, and end the war on terms favorable to the United States. A blind faith in mutual deterrence, Eakley believed, was like a declaration of faith during the Portuguese Inquisition, an auto da fé, an act that ends in a mass burning. 2 Air Force reports on the Titan II were released to the public in January 1981. One assessed the overall safety of the missile, and the other provided a lengthy account of the accident at Damascus. According to the 8th Air Force Missile Accident Investigation Board, Launch Complex 374-7 and its Titan II were destroyed by 3 separate explosions. The first occurred when fuel vapor ignited somewhere inside the complex. The vapor could have been ignited by a spark from an electric motor, by a leak from the Stage 1 oxidizer tank, or by the sudden collapse of the missile. A small explosion was followed by a much larger one as the Stage 1 oxidizer tank ruptured, allowing thousands of gallons of fuel and oxidizer to mix. The blast wave from this explosion tore apart the upper half of the silo, tossed the silo door 200 yards, and launched the second stage of the Titan II into the air. The door was already gone by the time the missile left the silo. The second stage soared straight upward, carrying the warhead, and then briefly flew parallel to the ground. Its rocket engine had been shoved into its fuel tank by the blast. Fuel and oxidizer leaked, causing the third explosion, producing a massive fireball and hurling the warhead into the ditch. The Accident Investigation Board determined the sequence of events by examining the fragmentation patterns of the missile and silo debris. Pieces of the second stage were found almost half a mile from the silo, while most of the first stage was scattered within 300 feet of it. The narrative offered by the report was factual and thorough, but the Air Force seemed more interested in describing how the accident unfolded than in establishing why it happened. It may not be important whether the immediate cause that initiated the explosive events is precisely known, the board argued, since over a period of time there were so many potential ignition sources available. The Titan II Weapons System Review Group report was prepared for members of Congress. The report contained a number of criticisms and a long list of recommendations for making the missiles safer. It said that the vapor detectors in Titan II silos were broken 40% of the time, that the portable vapor detectors rarely worked, that the radio system at launch complexes was unreliable and needed to be replaced, that missile combat crews should be discouraged from evacuating the control center during an emergency, that the shortage of REFCO suits often forced maintenance teams to be selected on the basis of who'd fit into the available suits instead of who knew how to do a particular job, that the suits and helmets were obsolete, that the air packs were obsolete, that some of the missile's spare parts were either hard to obtain or no longer manufactured, that security police officers should always be provided with maps, that lightning arresters and other modern safing features should be added to the W-53 warhead so that it would meet modern nuclear safety criteria for abnormal environments. The report also said that having a warning siren at every launch complex might be useful. The Titan II missile system was potentially hazardous, the Air Force concluded, but basically safe and supportable now and in the foreseeable future. Jeff Kennedy was angered by both of the reports. He'd spent weeks in the hospital battling the damage to his respiratory system and credited a young pulmonologist, Dr. James S. Anderson, not the Air Force, for saving his life. Anderson had sat at Kennedy's bedside for almost 40 hours straight, forcing him to cough up phlegm and clear his lungs. And Anderson had to improvise the treatment for nitrogen tetroxide exposure, since guidance in the medical literature was scarce and nobody from the Air Force would speak to him,